Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. I hope you're well. Thank you for all your lovely messages about Friday's episode, our little documentary on how to really make a mess of a reshuffle. It was nice to hear it from you all. And a hello to Ryan McCullen. He is in San Francisco, listens to the podcast at the gym. Love the pod, although it does make me laugh out loud, which is occasionally a little awkward. Well, we do our best, Ryan, we do our best. Coming up on today's episode, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. Every political party and government talks about it, but what is the reality? We take a look at how safe our streets really are and the government's latest plans to crack down on criminals. But first, we kick off, as ever, with our columnist panel. It's Monday, so it must be Libby Rachie. It's Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. So we'll come to theatres and culture and all of that in a moment. But Libby, I'm really taken by your column in the Times today about moral superiority and this idea of some people thinking that because they are goodies, then they can't be guilty of doing bad things. Explain yourself.
Well, it sparked off from the awful story, the way that big charities and the UN are so reluctant to police sexual exploitation because these are good people, they're good causes, they're better than the rest of us who just go around making money and getting on with our lives. And it sort of ballooned out into that great Francis Spufford book about why actually, whether you believe in God or not, the Christian way of accepting that we're all sinners is not daft. And I was raised on convent school stuff about daily examination of conscience and knowing there'll always be some little sin of some size, because that's just how human beings are. And we have this amazing delusion now of virtue signalling and empty words and these claims to be compassionate or dedicated to public service without a qualm, you know, and Harry and Meghan prating compassion and throwing the Queen under the bus and poor old Cameron. So I just thought, well, nervously, I'll have a go at the subject and admit there's probably some sort of sinful thoughts in it as well, because there always are, aren't there?
But it also made me think of Jeremy Corbyn as well. When he was leader of the Labour Party, because he was a nice man in the eyes of Corbynistas, and he'd campaigned on this and he'd campaigned on, there was no way he could have done anything bad when it came to anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I mean, this is the trouble. We've all got these flaws and we've all got these wrongthink things in ourselves and we've all got these spites. I mean, you just have to look at Twitter and see the extraordinary vitriol of some of the caring left. You know, if they come at you for not being caring enough, you know, it's sort of pistols at dawn. And it's absolutely extraordinary. But it is something we have to watch in ourselves all the time. I mean, all of us. And the nice Spufford point is that basically the Christian point of view of sort of saying, actually, yeah, we all need forgiveness to some degree, is not an unhealthy thing, whether you are a believer or not. So I just thought, let's drag that one out and see what happens.
What do you make of this, Rachel? This sort of the people on the moral high ground, and you know, particularly in the case that, as Libby was discussing, the people working for aid charities, some way convincing themselves to do that, they were able to do appalling things because they were there, you know, in the pay of charities doing good things.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? But I think actually this is really what's wrong with our politics at the moment, because it used to be the case that people on different sides of political debates could have an intellectual argument about something. They could disagree, but there was a kind of sense that you respected the other side. Whereas now, both sides or all sides seem to take the kind of so much the moral high ground. They see themselves as the only virtuous ones. And the opponents are the enemy, the evil doer, the devil. So therefore, it's impossible to have any kind of compromise, because if you're good, the other side's evil. How can you possibly come to any kind of arrangement between you? And you definitely saw that with the hard left and Jeremy Corbyn over anti-Semitism, that they couldn't understand that because they thought in their minds they were noble and campaigning on behalf of the Palestinian cause, that then somehow morphed sometimes into anti-Semitism. And I think also you see it on the right. So you've got Oliver Dowden today and over the weekend calling for, you know, on the one hand, they want free speech at universities and insisting that everyone must be open-minded and be able to say what they think. But on the other hand, he's saying that museums and galleries must follow a certain rules and the government-ordained view about British history and the empire. And there's this sense that instead of being able to have a debate about everything, the government saying, we're right on this, you're wrong, we're good, you're bad. And it's just another version of the same thing on left and right. It's become far too moralistic and it's not kind of rational.
Yeah, this is Oliver Dowden, the culture secretary, saying that Northerners should be included in prominent positions on cultural boards to erode the bias towards woke values held by a liberal London elite. This idea that sort of, you know, the board of the National Portrait Gallery meets and in the corner there's someone with sort of a pigeon under one arm and a whippet under the other and a flat cap saying, oh, I'm not sure about this.
But it's kind of virtue signalling of another kind.
Yes,
isn't it?
Exactly.
So the
exactly.
Woke warriors, you know, that the Tories but despise. But they're the kind of
Brexiteer brigadiers
just extreme.
Yeah. But I just don't think it's true anyway. I mean, I'm never happy about ministers dabbling their meaty paws into cultural institutions anyway. But I mean, I've been in a cultural bubble. I was 10 years a trustee of the National Maritime Museum. And I can tell you there were a lot of different opinions around that table, you know, from the Duke of Edinburgh down. And I think this is probably the case in most institutions. I think for every virtue signalling, boring old wokey, there will be a retro sentimentalist who absolutely hates what this person's saying. And I think the idea that the government would somehow balance it out with the pigeon and the whippet in the corner is both hilarious and rather sinister.
Oliver Dowden's piece in the Telegraph, Sunday Telegraph, was quite something. He said heritage institutions should be free from government meddling, but the people who run them need the courage to stand up against the political fads and noisy movements of the moment. It then goes on to say, that's why I want to make sure that the board of these bodies are generally diverse and not so free from meddling, apart from the good sort of meddling, which is my sort of meddling.
They have no sort of self-knowledge, do they? It's very, and it is just as much virtue signalling as the woke warriors, because they are saying, you know, we, the Brexiteer brigadiers, you know, we're championing our values. But actually, it's just as moralistic as the wokies, as Libby says.
Just to turn your column.
But I love it when you get a sort of slightly different slant. I did an interview the other day with Vanessa Redgrave, the famous old Workers' Revolutionary Party lefty, and I asked her about the statue thing, and she doesn't think statues should be knocked down at all. She says they should be up there so everyone remembers. And you know, I love this, that when people sort of veer off what you think they might say.
Oh, life and, is much more interesting when
think
that's
the freely.
Case. Yeah, yeah. Just flipping your column completely sort of upside down, Libby. The sort of cancel culture and one person, somebody who otherwise might be a good person, is judged to have done one bad thing, and then that sort of wipes out anything else that they might have done. It sort of does cut both. And I'm not really talking, obviously, here about the child abuse of by people working for charities, but the sort of everyone must either be a goodie or a baddie, and one bad thing apparently cancelling out an entire life's work.
Yes, that is quite extraordinary to me. And of course, what it is the people who are doing the cancelling cannot understand themselves the, if you want the Christian word, sinfulness of their intolerance. They don't get it. They think they are absolutely right, and therefore, you know, their cause, trans, whatever it is so right that you must absolutely demand complete recantation and so on from the person who disagrees with you. It's the inability to disagree politely that is something we have to get back to somehow. You know, radio stations are responsible for helping do that too, and doesn't do it too badly in your case.
Yeah. Very good. It's because we're just in the mushy middle. That's why. Somebody tweeted that this morning saying that I was slap bang right in the middle, which is, I'm totally happy with that. Others could do the extremes. One other thing I wanted to discuss this morning was this question of whether or not Olympians should skip the queue for jabs. There's lots of pressure for different people, you know, whether it's in different parts of the country or different jobs, to start getting vaccinated. But the cabinet minister is urging Boris Johnson to rush Olympic athletes and the British and Irons Lions rugby team to the top of the vaccine priority list, so they can go off and do their thing. What do you think about this, Rachel?
You know what? I'm absolutely happy for them to jump the queue. And I think, you know, I don't want sort of rich businessmen or politicians or anyone else jumping the queue. But these athletes, they're going abroad to race or whatever, or for their country, play for their country. And I think it's absolutely fine for them to get the jab. And most of them will be too young to have got it in the order of age that has been ordained by the government so far. So I think if these events do go ahead, which I guess the Tokyo Olympics is, they're saying it will go ahead, but it's looking a little bit rocky, isn't it? But I do think they should have them, actually. I think it's not that controversial. I don't think most people would mind. Maybe Libby disagrees.
I do. This is wonderful. We're having one of these polite disagreements, Rachel. I'm so enjoying it. I think it's the most abominable idea. I mean, to waste vaccine on a hollow prestige project like Olympic teams is abominable. I mean, it prioritises them in hotspots like Bolton for people in crowded multi-generational houses where some of the elders are hesitant and haven't had it. I mean, there are people very much needing prioritising for vaccines at the moment. And Olympians, I mean, at the very back of the queue, it fills me with absolute horror. Oh, for heaven's sake. You know, they're so young, they're fit, they're well nourished. You know, they're in no danger at all. You know, it would be completely a sort of, it would be a prestige-y thing to do. And I think it's sick.
Wow. Come on then, Rachel. Come on, fight back. Fight. Politely.
I'm not going to fight.
New Harry Hill
speaks. Point of view, but I just think they're not choosing to go abroad on holiday. They're going to compete for their country, and I think it's completely legitimate for them to have the vaccine. And most other countries in Europe and the US have given their athletes the jab as a priority. And also, bear in mind, I remember interviewing Tom Daley, the diver, actually, and he was making the point then if he did get COVID, it would be hugely detrimental to him because his lungs are so incredibly important to his sport. So these athletes who need to stay fit and healthy, I think they deserve the vaccine.
Well, there we are. Look at that, disagreeing politely. Let's see if we can end on a slightly more consensual note. Oh, we were talking about the fact that theatres are reopening and cinemas and everything else today. Libby, obviously, you've been reviewing theatre for how many years?
Oh, over 10 years now, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
so
I'm going to the cinema tonight, I have to say. I'm going to the cinema tonight.
What are you going to watch?
Couple of theatres coming. Going to watch The Dig because it's all filmed. Well, quite a lot of it is filmed or pretending to be filmed around where I live and Sutton Hoo and all the rest. And I want to see it on a great big screen. And so I'm going for that. And I'm going to go and see something. I'm going to go and see what's it called? The Nomad. What?
Nomadland.
I'm going to see that in a couple of days. And I've got a couple of theatres coming and I have no fear. I have no fear at all. There's a great gloomy, morbid piece in The Stage at the moment. I think it's in The Stage saying that actually it was always unhealthy going to theatres. You're always likely to catch something off the guy coughing behind you at the ballet. You know, it's always been the case. I thought, well, what a cheering thing to say right now.
What about you, Rachel? Have you got anything booked?
I haven't, but I want. There's a new James Graham play coming up at the Young Vic.
Yes,
really
I discovered that yesterday. It looks really
so
good.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
But I'm most looking forward just to seeing family and friends. I know it sounds slightly pathetic, but rather than going to any big events, I just want to see people who I haven't seen for far too long.
Yeah, that James Graham play, James has been on the show a few times. It's called Best of Enemies.
Yeah.
And it's about Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley Jr. It's American politics. Obviously, he did This House and Quiz.
But
and
it's I think it's actually about divisive politics and polarisation.
Who could have thought?
Yeah, very contemporary.
Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester, there you can read them both in The Times. Just get yourself a digital subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, we get tough on crime.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, let's talk crime.
Our Conservative Party is backing those who put their lives on the line for our national security. So as we renew our place as the party of law and order in Britain, let the message go out from this hall today. To the British people, we hear you. To the police service, we back you. And to the criminals, I simply say this. We are coming after you.
That's Priti Patel there addressing a room of Conservative Party activists when such things were allowed. But it's not only the Conservatives focusing on crime today. Labour are also announcing their plans with the release of a green paper on violence against women and girls. Now, if you look at the polling, about 90% of people say they feel safe walking on their local streets, according to YouGov's regular trackers. But less than half of people now say they have confidence in the police to deal with crime. That's the lowest since the tracker began 2 years ago. 23% of people say crime is one of the top three issues facing the country, up from 10% at the start of the year. We're now back to pre-pandemic levels. And 38% think that the country should be spending more on crime and policing. That rises to 58% among Tory voters who think we should spend more on the police, compared to just 21% of Labour voters who think the same. So today we're going to look at the party's plans for crime and the state of crime today. In a moment, we'll speak to former Chief Constable of Durham, Mike Barton. We've also got the Times crime correspondent, John Simpson, joining us. But first, let's speak to Jess Phillips, Labour's Shadow Minister for Domestic Violence and Safeguarding. Morning, Jess.
Morning, Matt.
What is it the government, not the government, what is it the Labour Party are announcing today?
So the Labour Party has today released a 27-page long document about how we would and would suggest that the government do also would tackle the scourge of violence against women and girls in our society. It is a broad-ranging document that covers sentencing, policing, how our criminal justice system works, but also how victims interact with housing, welfare, how education and online environments are also, I'm afraid to say, harming women and girls in our society.
And so what would you like to see done? Let's talk sort of actual real-life examples of changes that you think would make a difference.
Well, there's a huge amount of things that would make a difference. And in the document, we cover, you know, endless amounts of suggestions. But one suggestion is when I have to listen to Priti Patel there talking about how she's coming for criminals, well, she's not coming for rapists, because under her watch, the conviction rate for rape has dramatically dropped. It has been dropping and dropping for years. It is at a terribly low rate, and the vast majority of people who come forward to say that they've been raped, both women and men, but it's mainly women, what they will find is that their case won't even ever get inside a courtroom. And so what the Labour Party is proposing in this circumstance is a huge effort for police forces to be better resourced and have better facilities for serious sexual violence, for the CPS and the judiciary to have specific training, for there to be specific courts specialist courts that handle these things, and for victims to have the proper support to stop the 40% of victims who drop out before court, whether that's through independent sexual violence advisors, but also having legal representation, because I think most people think that a victim has a lawyer and a perpetrator in a court, a defendant has a lawyer, but in fact, a victim doesn't have a lawyer. A victim is merely a witness and a piece of evidence, and it's just simply not good enough, and it's leading to terrible conviction rates that the government have done nothing about. The document also lays out that we would want to have targets on the government around these things, because at the moment they just don't do very well. They stand on platforms and say they're tough on crime, while yesterday I had to talk down from a rape victim who has been handled terribly by the system, and that is an everyday occurrence for me.
How much of this is down to resources, that actually if you keep cutting it, you know, after 10 years of austerity, the system is stretched, and therefore the amount of support that's there, the amount of time that can be given to cases is affected?
Well, it's undoubtedly, there is a resources element to this. The vast majority of people coming forward about domestic and sexual violence into our system, let alone street harassment or stalking, those people don't come forward because the system is just not built for them. There aren't the charges. But the reality is that you'll be waiting. I've known cases of up to 4 years to have your rape trial heard. And that is directly because half of our courts have been cut. There aren't the specialist units in police forces. When they're promising 20,000 police officers in the street, they'll be taking us back to a level that we had at 2010, of course, before they cut all the police forces and all the specialisms in the police forces went by the wayside when resources were stretched. The CPS has been cut to the bone. So the reality is there is a resource issue, but there is also fundamental problems with how our system handles victims that need to be addressed, that won't just be addressed by more courts, more lawyers, more police. We need a fundamental change in how victims are treated within the system.
What is it that... Because if a case does go to court, you said the conviction rates are particularly bad. Is it a societal thing as well, a cultural thing that doesn't believe victims? And because of the nature of rape cases in particular, there's often not a huge amount of evidence. And it literally is he said, she said in law, or he said, or whatever it might be. So it's incredibly... culturally, do we need to change the conversation? Because it's very difficult, isn't it, for the government to... Or any political parties, or change the way society views these sorts of cases?
Absolutely. There is a fundamental where women are expected to tolerate a certain level of abuse in society. And the he said, she said element of it, their word against yours, is a very, very difficult thing. However, we have got to build a system, whether that is in our education, which again is in the document that we have produced today, and the policies that the Labour Party is proposing, is some of how we've got to look at how misogyny is dealt with in society, from girls not being able to walk to school in their school uniform without being curb crawled, to that when they're in school, sexist harassment, just not their voices not being able to be heard. There is a fundamental shift that has to be made, where we don't just expect half of the population to basically put up and tolerate a sort of degrading of our character based on our sex.
And do you think the Labour Party is seen as a party that would deal with this? It would be tough on crime. And it's obviously, Tony Blair famously was tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. In that clip, we heard Priti Patel talking about, we are now the party of law and order. Do you think that the Labour Party is seen as a party which could properly deal with these issues?
I think that potentially not as much as we should be at the moment. And that needs to be something that we absolutely lean on, because today, we have released policy that is far outstrips anything that was in the Queen's speech with regard to some of the most serious violent offences in our society, from murder, rape, that the government, murder last year of women was at its highest rate since 2016. How on earth can the government claim to be the party of law and order when more women are being murdered under their watch? And I'm afraid to say, more men are also being murdered.
That's an interesting point. So someone's just texted in saying, yet again, the Labour Party focusing on niche problems. Yes, domestic and sexual violence is important, but so are lots of other issues. Why are they not talking about policing, protests, immigration, knife crime, robbery, murder? that actually making it about, I mean, yeah, I totally, you know, your shadow brief, the shadow minister for domestic violence. But murder is up right across the board, as you were saying. Men, more men and more women are being murdered. Do you accept at all the criticism that Labour sometimes focuses on these niche things rather than the broad appeal?
I'm going to push back on the idea that women, who are 51% of the population, is niche. I'm delighted to be considered niche as somebody who has been through our court system 5 times in the last 2 years. I'm sorry that my issues are considered to be niche. Also, 25% of all call outs, the highest volume crime on its own, is domestic abuse. So it's not at all niche. And to suggest that because I care about domestic abuse means that I don't care about other forms of knife crime is like suggesting to somebody who comes on to talk about the cladding on high-rise buildings that they also hate people who live in bungalows. It is a nonsense, and I reject the premise. I care deeply about knife crime. I am the mother of 2 teenage sons living in the inner city. I'm here today to talk about women. They are not niche. They are more than half the population.
Anyway, Jess Phillips, thank you so much for joining us on Times Radio. Labour's Shadow Minister for Domestic Violence and Safeguarding, discussing those plans as set out by the Labour Party. Taking a look at crime today, because that's the debate on the Queen's speech, was happening in the House of Commons later on. Let's bring in Mike Barton, former Chief Constable. Morning, Mike.
Morning, Matt. I hope I'm not your token northerner.
Have you got your pigeon and whippet with you, Mike? That's the big question.
They're parked outside, don't worry.
Very good, very good. We're not making a lot of noise. That's obviously a reference to the government's approach to putting a northern one on the board of everything, and not because that's in any way the policy here. We've also got John Simpson, Times Crime Correspondent as well. Morning, John.
Morning. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm very good. So explain, if you can, for us, the government talking about the safe streets for all today. I mean, this bill, this piece of legislation, the Police Crime Sentencing in Courts Bill, I mean, that covers quite a broad range of issues. What is it that the government's proposing, first of all, John?
It's an enormous document that addresses, I mean, obviously, most prominently, we've heard about the changes to laws around protests. There's been a backlash against restrictions on protests, particularly details in the bill that would make it far easier to shut down protests for creating a nuisance, noise levels, and a space around Parliament where protests would not be allowed to be held. But actually, this document has far wider reaching implications. There are changes to sentencing around the whole life sentences. So the premeditated murder of a child would automatically receive a whole life sentence as a starting point. There are changes to sentencing for repeat offenders, making it easier to give them longer sentences. There are also some changes to custodial policy around children, diverting them from custody where possible, and formalization of practice around digital evidence to try to address some of the issues that we have around disclosure where police are searching computers and mobile phones.
And given your experience reporting on crime for the Times, how much of this is sort of addressing things which really need addressing, and how much of it, you know, because obviously sometimes governments tend to do things because they look politically quite good, or they're addressing public concern rather than reality. What is the, is there anything which you think, well, hang on, that, you know, this is cracking down on something which isn't actually that big a problem right now, or particular issues which you think are pretty urgent?
I think that there's always massive debate around sentencing, whatever the crime. We live in a very victim-led society, which I think in many ways is correct. You know, victims must be heard. But having worked with a lot of victims and families of victims, they will always want longer sentences for offenders. Whether or not that is going to address the problems in a country where we jail more people per capita than anywhere else in Western Europe, whether it's a policy that simply wins votes, or addresses the root of the problem is another matter.
Let's bring in Mike there. Mike, Mike Barton, you were chief constable of Durham Constabulary. How much, when you were doing that job, how much time did you spend trying to sort of address that mishmash between what politicians might say about what they were doing, they were cracking down on all that, and the reality of what you were dealing with on the streets of your area?
Thanks very much, Matt and John, for your praise on that. Crime has never been as low in the real world. Certainly online, it's burgeoning and something ought to be done about that. But in the real world, violent crime now is half it was in 1995. And I know that's no solace to people who've been the victim of that recently. We actually did a survey of victims, John, in Durham, because we were looking at doing more restorative justice, trying to prevent the next generation of criminals coming out of criminogenic families. And we actually found that victims don't want longer sentences generally. Occasionally, but generally what they want is they don't want it to happen to somebody else. So preventing crime is the critical issue. So we've actually got to look at what the kids are. So when Jess Phillips was talking about DV, domestic violence, not being a niche subject, she's absolutely spot on, because when children are brought up in households with domestic violence, they are far more likely to become offenders and have bad health outcomes themselves. So that's the sort of work we were involved in, Matt, where we were trying to be really smart and following the science to try and prevent crime in the future. So that's why I get really cross with politicians who say that they all want to claim the moral high ground and the party of law and order, when actually, and they're talking about longer sentences. Sentences have doubled in the last 10 years. Now, the public don't realise that because the politicians tell them lies.
And I was going to ask you about that, because that's the thing, is that you get successive Home Secretaries saying they're getting tough on this, they're cracking down on that. A particular issue flares up and it might be a trend, or it might be one case one crime or another. And, you know, the cry goes up, something must be done. So the easiest thing is we're going to double sentences for X situation. But you're right, it might not act as a deterrent, and it might not stop that person once they've completed that sentence from doing it again.
There's only one deterrent, Matt. All the surveys in history have shown this: fear of getting caught. It's nothing to do with the length of sentence. And they found this out with hanging. So they all thought that hanging people publicly would stop people murdering people. Then they found out in the 1850s that everyone except one person in the last 10 years who'd been convicted of murder had actually seen a public hanging. So they stopped hanging people publicly because they realised that wasn't the deterrent. So sabre-rattling sounds good and some people might fall for it. But what really makes the difference is people fearing getting caught. And that's why I'm worried about the loss of 20,000 officers. And the ones that are replacing them, that's fine. But they will be rookie cops in the first 2 years, certainly not specialists and certainly not detectives. And the one thing that I'm worried about is that deterioration in our investigative capacity over the last 10 years. That's what's worried me in terms of putting the fear into the criminal.
And interestingly, John Simpson, there was a story in the Times last week, I think, about looking at sort of trying to forecast where there might be growth in crime. Sexual offences and violence are due to increase by a fifth over the next 2 years compared with pre-pandemic levels. This was some research by PolScope with Crest Advisory, the criminal justice consultancy, and Justice Episteme, looking at the crimes that have been uploaded and what might happen in the future. Drugs offences, public order crimes, including harassment, violent disorder, affray, been drunk and disorderly, also likely to rise. Burglary, which has been in decline since the mid-1990s, is also expected to fall by a third. Robbery also set to decrease. So the sorts of crimes we're talking about are changing, John.
Yes, and we're having this discussion at a very strange point in time where, you know, we're about to reopen society. Compared to last year, we're going to see huge increases in crime, and police forces are going to have to model not on comparative data from last year, but from pre-pandemic levels, and try to gauge those patterns and the changes in the way that offending happens. As Mike mentioned, that online fraud, etc., is expanding at a rate that we just cannot keep up with. But pre-pandemic, we were seeing increases in violence, murder and sexual offences year on year for about 5 years. And the way in which we combat that is going to define the next decade.
What's your, because obviously the government, if in doubt, Boris Johnson and Priti Patel talk about we're recruiting 20,000 more police. As Mike said, a lot of that is replacing police that were cut before. They need to be the right sort of officers and the right covering the right sort of crimes as well, don't they? This idea of a bobby on the beat, people seeing more police, doesn't actually make a huge amount of difference to actually cracking cases.
I mean, there's a debate about around visual deterrence in the street and seeing an officer. There haven't been an awful lot of studies that tell us exactly the impact on having officers on the streets. But yeah, I mean, in terms of proactive policing, newly recruited PCs are not going to make the difference. And forces for years now have been struggling to recruit the requisite number of detectives to deal with serious and organised crime.
Mike, just finally, if you were in Priti Patel's seat or, you know, able to whisper in her ear, what would you actually say is something that she could do to tackle the sorts of crimes which are actually rising? Let's put it like headlines to one side. How do we end up with fewer crimes being committed and fewer people ending up in prison?
Half of all crime is now on the internet. If people selling cars sold them without locks and doors, there'd be an outcry, and Ford and Audi and the rest of them would have to put doors on and would have to put locks on. It wouldn't make sense. So how come Facebook and all the platforms are allowed to make their platforms criminogenic? Why is Mark Zuckerberg not being in the dock of public opinion because he is allowing child abuse on his platforms? They know it. They could design it out. They could design out a system where if you searched for child rape, it would be prevented and there would be all sorts of algorithms kicking into place. They don't. They choose not to. Half of all crime could be prevented by the social media platforms who now have more money than nation states. She should be doing that rather than milking that vein of public opinion where she says she's tough on crime. She isn't, because they're doing nothing about online crime.
And what about you, John? You spend a lot of time looking into criminal trends and all that sort of thing for the Times. What would you suggest to Priti Patel if she picked up the phone to you?
I mean, I think a lot of what I deal with is violent crime, and an increased focus on domestic violence and also non-policing responses to crime, and it gets spoken about a lot. And when we talk about street violence, gang crime, a lot of the issues that police are dealing with day to day don't start from a law enforcement perspective. So whether you increase investment in youth services, etc., which have been decimated, whether we work on education programs that teach young men how to treat young women, but it's stepping away from the sharp end of it and seeing what we can do around the social issues that feed into it.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?